Welcome to the Together PDX podcast. You're listening to our Gospel Gathering series, where we will be replaying valuable content from past events where local Portland leaders gathered to hear from authors, theologians, and scholars. We'd like to note that the views shared by our guests don't necessarily reflect those of the entire Together PDX team. We pray today's content enriches your day and spirit. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Together PDX podcast. I'm your host, Elise Gallus, and today I have a fascinating talk for you from Mark Sayers. You're probably familiar with Mark's work, but for those of you who aren't, he is passionate about spiritual renewal and the future of the church. Mark is the senior leader of Red Church in Melbourne, Australia, the author of a number of books, including Strange Days and Reappearing Church, and he hosts the Rebuilders podcast. In this particular talk you're about to hear, he spoke to about 300 pastors and church leaders here in Portland, Oregon in September 2024 about how we're on the cusp of a new cultural era, which presents gospel opportunities and discipleship advantages for those who orient themselves biblically in this moment. This is When the Secular City Has a Faith Crisis, Understanding the Emerging Post-2022 Era with Mark Sayers.
Well, it's so good to be back in Portland. It's been a real privilege to visit this part of the world for a number of years. I mean, it's probably over 10 years. I've been coming here every couple of years. Did this cultural moment in the basement of the church, Baptist Church downtown. And in 2019, I really felt the Lord say to me not to come back to America until He told me to. Recently felt that door open again. And it's really interesting coming back 5 years later because a lot's changed. Some of it obvious, some of it less obvious because it's incremental change. And when you live in a place, it's like your kids. You don't notice your kids are growing, but then like you'll see that auntie hasn't seen him for a couple of years and like, oh, you've grown. Portland, this area has grown. Things have happened. Changes have happened. But really what I want to sort of talk about today is some of the spiritual dynamics that I think are changing. And I'm going to make a bold assertion. You are in one of the best contexts to be a minister in the world at the moment. I'm going to repeat that because you may not have heard it because of my accent, but also you may have heard it. You may have heard it and not wanted to hear it. You are in one of the best contexts to be a minister in the world at this moment. Yesterday, I just had a moment in between meetings. I had an hour or so where I just was gathering some of the thoughts of what to share in my hotel room. And the surface story that this part of the world tells about itself is how different it is to the rest of the country. America is a deeply religious place, unusual amongst Western countries in its levels of religiosity. But the story that's often told about this city and this part of the world is that in some ways this is sort of a future, a post-Christian reality, where there's not just a post-Christianity that perhaps you have in Australia, which is more just sort of almost lazy, comfortable. It's like falling asleep in a warm bath. Where here there's very obviously a kind of rejection of certain things which many of us would really hold dear. I was walking down at this Alberta Avenue, whatever it is, and there was some street art and there was a picture of a Bible and it had on the cover fake news. That's a pretty obvious statement about a cultural value that's on the surface. So being a minister here can feel like, why here? By being here, I'm going to naturally perhaps not have some of the advantages where things are easier in other parts of the country. I have spent almost most of my time in visiting the United States speaking in secular places here, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Austin, New York, places like that. But on this trip, been to Texas, went to Kentucky, never been to Kentucky. It's another world. I was having culture shock. Like, I come to Portland, I don't have culture shock. Like, it's like Melbourne in many ways. But Kentucky, man, I had culture shock there. Like, but therapy has helped. And there almost could be a sense, I think, particularly in your country, where in my country there's not like some great Christian, you know, bubble I can go and visit and do ministry in, which is easier. Melbourne is hard, but most of the country is like that. Historically, the first church in Australia was burnt down. The government from its get-go was, you know, very sort of scientific, rationalist. It was when the British Empire had sort of reached this rational level and Christianity was very simply a thin veneer of culture. The Lord Melbourne, who my city is named after, British Prime Minister, actually complained about evangelicals and the fact that they actually believed the stuff versus it just being a thin veneer from which to sort of give some spiritual legitimacy to the British Empire. So in a place like this, you can feel like, man, it would be easier somewhere else. And I think also the sense that I just pick up in the country as a whole, but also just chatting to people here, there's a sense of exhaustion in this country, punch drunkness, a sense that, wow, we've had sort of one shock now for perhaps almost 10 years after another, seeing things we never thought we'd see and seeing things heading in a direction. One thing that is really interesting is there's no group that I can think of in the United States at the moment who feels that the future's very bright. Even the AI people, which is the front end of development and research and perhaps the next wave of productivity from this country, they are excited, but also believe that they may end humanity. So there's a downer with everything at the moment. But in my hotel room yesterday, I was thinking about some of these things and what the Lord wanted me to say. And I'm there and there's that moment around 10 o'clock when you're in hotels and, you know, room service starts to come around and, you know, knock on your door. And I hadn't put the little note up saying, not disturb me. And I just heard something. Like, I could hear that song. I know that song. I know that voice. And I can hear from the hallway my friend Tim Hughes' voice singing. And I then hear the woman who's changing over the rooms, worshiping. Here I am to worship. Here I am to bow down. Here I am to say that you are Lord. And I thought, one of the things that we can miss in cities is that cities almost have a propaganda and ideology which says it's the dominant one that competes for attention. But often there's quieter stories, subtexts, underneath the surface. And I just felt in that moment, the Lord saying, yeah, there's another Portland. It's not the one they're gonna put on the shiny ads to come and visit the city. It's not the one that's gonna be in the prime, you know, locations in the best coffee shops. But there is a story, God is here at work. And I just wanna also say that I think God is going to do some work here. It's very apt we just watched that video. We're gonna have to get used to the fact that people who we thought are very far from God are closer than we realize. So let's dive in. Also, just to warn you, I do exert large amounts of information and I've learned over the years that I will often sort of drop bombs that people are like, what? And then I'm like, on to the next point. So what I've learned to do over the years is I will stop at different points to allow you just to decompress, turn to the person next to you and process some stuff before I move on to the next thought. I also drink a lot of water. Once got a letter like complaining about my drinking of water. Who has the time? Like, what are you doing tonight, dear? Well, I'm gonna sit down and write that letter to Mark Sayers about his water consumption during talking. Like, sorry, man, I've got to get a dry mouth talking, whatever. This is not why we're here. Okay, I come here could be 8 years ago, and do a very similar event to this. Maybe some of you were there. It was in a whitish church building. There was a big, like, chalkboard at the front. And I communicated a number of things that I'd been thinking about, what it is to do church mission in secular, progressive cities like yours and mine. And for me, I realized that a lot of what I'd learned in Melbourne was really applicable here, and it just was a resonance that in other cities, when I communicate that stuff, they're more thinking, oh, this is the future. But I noticed like, wow, we're on a very similar wavelength. A lot of those ideas were captured in a book called Disappearing Church. I didn't want to call it Disappearing Church. I wanted to call it The Beautiful Apocalypse. I thought that was a cool title. But, you know, publishers and all had this big chat, went with Disappearing Church. It had a very dark cover. And there was a negative hue to it. I still think it's really worth reading, but I think it captured something that I was feeling, which was, we're seeing a new shift in culture And this shift is going to be really tough for the church. I, at that time, had seen most of my peers in Oz deconstruct and walk away. I remember visiting a NGO, Christian NGO, and seeing all these guys who 10 years earlier I was praying with for God to move in the city, planting churches, who had left that and now were sort of working in these NGOs, not doing what I knew was what the Lord had put on their hearts. And so almost the message really of that book and of that time, and really did flow into, you know, the first couple of seasons of This Cultural Moment, when I look back and sort of, you know, examine what I was saying at that time, it was almost this sense that there is this new, very corrosive cultural context coming, and cities like yours and mine are the first places where this is springing up, and it's post-Christian. Like, post-Christian is not just like we don't go to church anymore. Post-Christian is a culture which has consciously defined itself against church and Christianity. And this presents a real challenge to the church, because you're not almost dealing with apathy as much as you're dealing with opposition. And I could see that churches were beginning to shrink in my city. I could see that many of the church growth strategies that had been employed for years, which had seen some churches grow in the 1980s and 1990s, were no longer working. I remember hearing from a large denomination who'd been very successful all over the place and in my nation, said that Melbourne, they planted in last because it's just tough soil. So for me, I would describe my sort of approach to ministry at this time is, how do we create resilient disciples who can withstand this sort of onslaught? And how do you just like almost just keep everyone like this and just like, let's not lose you? That's really what I reflect back when I look at it now. And how do we do this? We do these things. We do counterformation and practices against what is happening in the broader culture. That moment has passed. I don't think that anymore. Because what I had to do was to be attuned to the next thing that God is doing and the current culture reality. And I just want to throw a word at you, a phrase rather, that has been thrown around and it's been used to describe a shift in fashion, but I'm going to apply it to church. And so after the pandemic, there was a number of articles which flew around saying that a vibe shift has occurred. Right, what's a vibe shift? Here's a quote from Allison P. Davis, who I think is in fashion in New York. A vibe shift is the catchy but sort of too cool term for a relatively simple idea. In the culture, sometimes things change and a once dominant social wavelength begins to feel dated. We're in a vibe shift around secularism. Now, the guy who coined this term, a fashion trend forecaster in New York called Sean Monahan, basically said this: the idea of a vibe shift was very much informed by the late spring of 2021. Now, just if you're a millennial in the room, just you'll get through this, all right? Millennials went into lockdown, still feeling very young, but they came out shocked to find the first cohort of Zoomers, or Gen Z, and it is Z, now ruling the roost. I experienced this. I went on a train after lockdown and there's a bunch of Gen Z on the train and like something profoundly changed. I went into lockdown and I had a view of what young adults talked like, felt like. No, that's why do they feel? I'm not feeling them. That's that. Okay, let's just move on. That felt strange. And I said felt again. Anyway, okay, I got jet lag. I've been in four time zones. Young adults, in my head, I had a view of what they were like. I'm then on the train, I went to the football, and all around me are these young Aussie guys in particular, and everyone came out of the lockdown in Australia with a mullet and a moustache. Now, my entire generation defined ourselves against Aussie males with mullets and moustaches. This was deeply traumatising for me. That was everything that was out of fashion. And not only did they different, like the whole sort of like, I don't know, aesthetic that I used to be dealing with young adults of like, you know, do you want that coffee? Which one do you want? It was like, they were talking like 1940s working class Aussie males. They were talking about my grandfather. I'm like, something has shifted here. But what I began to realize is that there's a greater vibe shift happening culturally, but it's also happening spiritually. And it's happened really quick. How do we miss it? Well, number one, during the pandemic, everyone looked at the world even more so just online. And the internet is a very poor guide to what is really happening in the world. In the British election, I think it's when David Cameron won, one of the terms that then was thrown up was that Labour, the left-wing party in Britain, absolutely believed they were going to win. And Twitter, British political Twitter, which I do hang out on, British political Twitter, basically had a meltdown when the Conservative Party won because all of these people had been not looking at polls, just looking at what was happening on Twitter, and they thought that is what the public thought. And then when it didn't happen and the Conservatives won this election that Labour thought they had in the bag, all of a sudden this term was coined, the Twitter bubble, now the X bubble. So the internet is a poor guide to what's really happening and can place us in a bubble. Sean Monahan, again, the trend forecaster, says this, the internet is mundane, real life is where the action is. I'm just going to repeat that. Internet is mundane, real life is where the action is. Which is example I gave at the beginning of, hang on, there's people in Poland who are doing their jobs playing worship. There's something happening out there. The other thing is, as you age, you can often miss the passage of time. And as you get older, there's this horrible realization where the jacket you have in the back of your cupboard that you haven't thought that you've worn for a year or two, it's actually been 7 years, and that's gone out of fashion, but even more horrifying is now back in fashion. And so partially what Sean Monahan said about the pandemic was that particularly for younger adults and millennials who went into the pandemic, they experienced what was known as the Peter Pandemic phenomenon. Well, they came out thinking about Peter Pan, but no. The second thing is because of the internet as well, we're in a moment where algorithmically we copy everyone. There is sort of this mimetic copying of everyone that we're not aware of. So we simply repeat what everyone else is doing. This has become even more so in the internet age. Someone starts church like this in some city on their online service, and all of a sudden, within 3 months, everyone's doing it in the same way. But lastly, we live in a bubble. And the word bubble is one which has often been used of the church at times when the church created this distance from culture, and you'd have the Christian Basketball Association, you'd have the Christian school, you'd have the Christian cafe, you'd have parts of town where lots of Christians live and there's lots of churches. And there's certain parts of the country where you could live in and you live in this Christian bubble, rarely ever rubbing shoulders with someone who doesn't have faith. And you can even do that in the midst of a community to create this little Christian bubble world. So what I want to really focus on is this idea of a bubble. I've talked about Twitter bubbles. I've talked about living in a bubble. But I want to talk about the idea of a bubble in a very different way. There is a kind of bubble that you need to be aware of in Portland. That's a kind of Christian bubble, but not one in which people live in like hiding from the world. And to explain this, I want to tell the story of my state of Victoria. Melbourne is in the state of Victoria. And Melbourne starts off as some people from Sydney decide just to head down out without permission and start a little town. And they start this little town and it just, you know, peters along there. This is in the early 19th century. But then in the middle of the 19th century, something is discovered and it's gold. And gold is found in the center of my state. And people from all over the world begin to come. There are people come from the United Kingdom. There's a massive Chinese migration to my state. And there's just mass immigration. And there's also a significant amount of people who really are one of the most troublesome immigrant groups, people from the United States. They come out from the California Gold Rush ends, come out to my state, and very quickly, Melbourne changes incredibly fast. You have people who had no money, working class people, people from poor areas, people from rural China, you know, the countryside in Britain, come discover gold. It's like almost near the surface. Like people are just making fortunes. And Melbourne's like a Dubai. It starts to grow. And it's seen as one of the most futuristic, beautiful cities in the world. The term it had in the 19th century was marvelous Melbourne. And there's this really weird moment in the 19th century where Melbourne and Buenos Aires are seen as two of the leading cities in the world. Visitors to Argentina at that time would actually talk about how far Argentina was ahead and futuristic compared to the United States, which felt like a backwater at that time. So cities change and there's different phases. And what happens is people start to invest their newfound money that they've just discovered in the gold fields into property. And Melbourne goes crazy for property. Buildings are built, factories are built, but homes are bought. And people who've come from crowded European cities or crowded Chinese cities all of a sudden can get a house with a large backyard and a wonderful garden. And what happens is there's a point where the property market grows, but then it moves into what is known as a housing bubble. This is an economic condition where there is a kind of mania that takes over the economy. Schiller wrote a book called Narrative Economics, where he said actually what John Maynard Keynes called the animal spirits, that sense of enthusiasm, of hype, or sometimes negativity around certain stocks in the economy, often drives it more than the actual reality of the worth of things. A famous example of this is in the Dutch Republic in the 16th century, when all of a sudden people went mad for tulips. There'd been a particular kind of pest and disease that tulips at that time in Europe were getting, and it meant that tulips then for 1 year developed the most vivid colours that anyone had ever seen. And a few people started buying them, like rich people, and then it became a thing where like you're a certain kind of person if you've got a tulip in your house. Near the end of the tulip mania, people were selling their homes to buy single tulips. Now, tulips are beautiful, but they do not last. And there was a point where, which comes in every bubble, where people go, hang on, this is insane, and then it pops. So people lost so much money when tulips started to rot, and they're like, I would have rather had my house than this sort of brown set of leaves and petals that's now on my dining room table. Melbourne then hits the peak of its property bubble in around 1890. And the city that is seen as was the second biggest city in the British Empire at this time, all of a sudden the bubble pops, the market falls, and there is a great depression in my city. Bubbles pop. When a bubble pops, what seemed like the intractable direction of the future, the inevitable endless ascent, all of a sudden becomes a descent. There's a plot twist. And when bubbles pop, what seems solid all of a sudden becomes fragile. I am going to say this. The secularism bubble is popping. Secularism bubble is popping. But there's another bubble that is also popping. The United States had a large cultural Christian bubble. Many people who would turn up, so a church somewhere in the country, probably not so much Portland, could have so many bums on seats, so many people there, so many people coming through their programs. But there was an inflation where it was actually not a true value of worth, where all of a sudden they're like, look, have you seen this church? They've got 20,000 people or whatever. But their services keep getting reduced in time. People come less and less often. There's so many people coming through the door, but the depth of discipleship is actually quite low. And then all you need is sometimes like an economic shock somewhere. The United States, so much of what has happened, and I'll talk about this in a second, in terms of culture, really can be traced back to a moment. Political polarization that is happening now in the United States, so much of it can be traced back to 2008 and the global financial crisis, where the market was juiced. I won't do a whole lecture on the global financial crisis, but effectively these very unique kind of financial products where all this debt was taken from houses and all these housing tracts built in places like Florida was all sold and cut up and thinly sliced. And the whole thing was a giant bubble waiting to pop. This is happened to the church. When COVID happens and it becomes hard to come to church, all of a sudden you see the fragility of the bubble. When polarization comes through a culture and the idea of discipleship is swamped by political affiliation and theology is almost less important than politics, you see how fragile a bubble is. In Australia, our culture of Christianity is different. It's not political. Australia is not polarized like America is. We have a little bit of it, but Pew Research did a whole study of like 40, 50 countries around the world. And what was unusual about Australia is we came out of, yes, all the lockdowns you heard about, we came out of that less polarized than we went in. So it's not inevitable there's polarization around the world just simply because you had a pandemic. And what happens in Australia, though, is because our culture of Christianity is based on comfort, I want to go to church, don't want it to push me too much, and then I'll be able to go to the beach afterwards and maybe get to the kids' soccer game, is church became difficult. We had periods where literally you had to be 2 meters square, you couldn't sing at bits, and you really found out that when church was not fun, and you're there to worship and you can't even sing, the consumer Christian thing goes out the window and you're there for one reason. It's like, I'm here for Jesus. This is not a fun experience. I can't even connect with people because we've got to get to the building afterwards. And so you very quickly saw in my country, but particularly yours, because yours had a much larger swathe of cultural Christianity, is that that bubble popped. One of the reasons it's good to be in this part of the world is that bubble popped here a while ago. It's a lot harder to do church here and just do, you know, some Christian products for lots of people who can come along who want religious goods and services. But the other thing I just want to dig into is the sense that secularism has also been a bubble. Now I'm gonna just do this little bit and then I'm gonna go through a few points, but I'm gonna give you a break in a second to process some things I'm saying. We need to think in eras to understand the history of the world. And I would say we've been in a couple of key eras and we've just come to the end of one. The big broad umbrella era really begins in 1989, when since the Second World War, the world had been defined by a Cold War. Two big blocks in the world, two competing ideologies, communism and liberal democracy. You literally had an iron curtain across Europe which divided this. You could not get across the border between those two ideologies in the world. But in 1989, communism collapses. The Berlin Wall falls, Mikhail Gorbachev is unable to hold the Soviet Union together, and the utter unthinkable happens where communism falls. People, the CIA did not, they thought it was a ruse, literally. They were so invested in being in the Cold War, they thought it was a ruse. They couldn't believe what was happening. There's this moment where Vladimir Putin, who was stationed as an FSB or KGB officer at the time in Berlin, sees the people going onto the streets and he rings back to Moscow to basically say, you need to send in troops, we're losing order here, and no one in Moscow answers the phone call. That is a defining moment for Vladimir Putin. So all of a sudden then the world goes almost into a kind of elation. Communism falls and the world seems to be moving towards this liberal democratic moment. The American political science, Francis Fukuyama, has this theory of the end of history. History's come to an end. The future is simply going to be a liberal democracy that's slowly sliding towards utopia. We didn't have to try much. Robert Greenspan, the head of the US Fed, basically says, we're just gonna not have any depressions or recessions anymore. We're just gonna economically move to just this better world. The internet is birthed at this time. And if you read the early internet books, it says that the internet is going to get rid of loneliness. It's going to join us together. It's going to make politics more functional. It's going to make people nicer. And all the dictators and authoritarians in the world will fall. It's going to be an overwhelming win for society. And there is this moment of a kind of false reality that comes into the world. We are in a bubble being protected from reality. And you look at one of the most popular shows in that time, Seinfeld. Seinfeld is ultimately a show about nothing. And this is a period about nothing. It's Elaine and Jerry talking about, you know, whether this waiter tipped the right way or what's this deal with, you know, ketchup on cafe tables or something like this. And it's hard to think about it now. I remember literally going to one of the first things I did. I was a youth pastor intern. And I went to this university ministry seminar and the guy got up and goes, I'm in university ministry and all of the political movements on university have died. The 60s is dead. The most popular group the only movement happening at this university at this time, which in the 60s was like a hotbed of activism, is the chocolate club. Well, what's the chocolate club? They get together and they eat chocolate. And like the Marxists and all these people, they couldn't get enough people for quorum. So they're like, hey, just walking around saying, are you a Marxist? No, but can you just join us so we can actually have our meeting, or I'll be a Marxist for 15 minutes. Great, we've got 10 people. Politics was dead. It was a time of nothingness. Now that's also the time when so many of our ideas around church and church growth strategies actually were developed, where you could just turn up, there was this sort of mass culture, everyone should just come. Churches increasingly sort of look like the same color scheme, Frank Lloyd Wright color scheme of malls. Churches look like corporate culture. And it's like the market took over everything and everyone was just this consumer, and church became in many places just a consumer good that you just came in, plugged in, and just had a nice life application sermon, nice bit of worship, and Bob's your uncle, there's your church. But things, as I said, start to go awry. We don't notice the shocks. They come, but their full effect is not felt. One is September 11th. Not just the attacks, that there's a sense that the world out there can come in here, and a jihadist movement in the Middle East can change the world with really quite a cheap strategy. The most powerful aren't as powerful as they thought. This creates a surveillance state where all of a sudden the things that had held back a lot of the internet from coming into our lives were pulled back because the intelligence agencies of Western governments realized that, yes, people are going to lose some freedom, but we can then see a lot of stuff. And there was a devil's bargain done with corporations where all of a sudden this enabled it to be so invasive in our lives. Global financial crisis, 2008. The wheels of the economy, which had seemingly created this endless growth, began to fall off. The response to the global financial crisis was to do quantitative easing, which is basically, in even layman's terms, printing money. The global economy really starts to stagnate in 2008, but we start printing money, which creates this false reality that things are growing, and it creates another bubble to replace the bubble that just was. But then in 2014, it becomes really key. So imagine like an era from 1989 to 2014. In 2014, all of a sudden people start noticing, hang on, something has changed. The rise of social media begins to change the world. It goes from like, hey, like I've got 30 friends on Facebook and I'm catching up with that guy from, you know, high school that I lost touch with, to a year later, like, who are all these people and why are they adding me? And I don't want to know about the personal things in their lives. This is simply too much. But then what begins to happen is we begin to see the political effect of these things on society. You see this polarization begins to grow as institutions, in a sense, are gone around. There's good stuff to this. There's a sense that hidden voices can be raised up, but also creates this sense of disequilibrium in the culture. You see that all of a sudden, there seems to be this anxiety which is becoming normative everywhere. All of a sudden, in 2016, you start to see political results which no one could have expected. Brexit, election of Donald Trump in this country. All of the pollsters said it's not going to happen. All of the experts said it's not going to happen. And you start to get this idea that, hang on, the people who we thought were the expert class who'd guided us since 1989, they don't actually know what's going on. And the impossible all of a sudden starts to seem possible. At this moment, there is just this seemingly like avalanche of stuff coming up from the surface. The repression of politics, all of a sudden, the surface breaks and Jerry Seinfeld's like era's over, and it just explodes to the surface in so many different areas. And then it just starts to become difficult to be a pastor. You're dealing with issues which come at you like almost like a sort of electronic mob where you're just swept up into stuffing and you're like, where on earth did that come from? It's like the extremes all of a sudden have overtaken the center. The period from 1989 to 2008 is the period of the center, but then we go to different extremes and they just keep going. There's almost this internet dynamic that if you're going to go here, well, you outdo the next person by going there, and then you outdo the next person by going there. And we begin to see ideologies all over the place which people don't recognize. The world seems to change. The people who you thought the same as you don't think the same as you. And this country, this is the phenomenon, really, of polarization. Now, this has so defined so many people's view of the world, and so many people are still reeling from the loss of a world which felt in a sense, more safe, more secure, more understandable. And many people, when you talk to them, feel like they've been in a bit of a foreign land. My head is spinning. I don't know what this is with all the changes. In New Zealand, the Nationals just won the election against Jacinta Ardern's Labour Party about a year and a half ago or something. And it was really interesting. The Nationals, so the Conservative Party, did research and they found there was a new kind of conservatism rising in New Zealand. But it was a conservatism where people didn't want to go back to a golden period of the 1950s. People desperately wanted to go back to the golden period of 2015, when actually they felt like they could understand the world. Now, I think pastorally, a lot of pastors want to go back to the golden world of 2015 when it did not seem so complicated. And then when if that's enough, COVID comes. I was in Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, and I was at an Alpha Asia gathering. I'd been watching what was happening in China. I live in a very very Chinese area. And in January, like the mall I go to, which is like 95% Chinese shops and Chinese people, it just locks down early. I'm like, what is going on? Everyone's wearing masks. I'm like, it's not in the media. I'm like, something is coming. I go to Malaysia and I'm talking to Singaporean pastors who are like, we're going to go online. I'm like, what? I start telling people this. I'm coming back to Australia, like, get ready. Like, we're going to go online. We're going to go into lockdown. And there's just people like, come on, mate. Come on, like, mate, you're over the top. It's never going to happen. I'm like, you watch. And again, the impossible became possible. Okay, so we then go into lockdown. In cities like this, it was more lockdown than other parts of the country. But something happens in COVID, which is about more than the pandemic, is that the bubble of so many things begins to burst. The bubble pops. Now, the danger is we can be defined by what has happened between 2016 and say 2021, 2022, and we can miss what is now happening. And what I'm going to say is now happening, and I'll dig into this more. I'm going to let you turn to the person next to you. Is secularism is now having its deconstruction moment. Secularism is having a crisis of faith. The bubble has burst and the ideology is not meeting reality and people are hurting. Is it in the mainstream media? No. Is it the New York Times going to tell you this? No. Is even that conference you just went to in church going to tell you? No, because they're getting stuff offline. But on the street, in ordinary people online, in face-to-face, Sean Monaghan, inventor of the vibe shift, is right. The internet is mundane, real life where it's at, and something is profoundly changing. Turn to the person next to you and discuss whatever just stood out from that epic beginning monologue. Okay, in the next, just as we come to the end of this first talk, I want to give you five reasons why I think secularism has hit its moment of doubts. The first one is this. Secularism, the very word secular, when you use it in economics, a secular decline means an inevitable decline of something, productivity or house growth. So the word secular is framed in a particular way that it's inevitable. And it emerges from an ideology that really begins in, you know, the 17th, 18th century in Europe, the Enlightenment, through people like Denis Diderot, Voltaire, Gibbon, that the world had this golden period. It was the classical world was this golden period. But then the world went into a decline, a kind of dark ages when Christianity came. Gibbon wrote The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, looking at these ancient ruins and like that was the golden time. And then the superstition of Christianity ruined it all. And so we need to be enlightened from this darkness. And in French, the Lumières, like this, the lights, the bright ones who looked at things through rational, scientific rigor, would bring light into the world and would dispel darkness from the world. And this was seen as an inevitable direction of history. And so this is why they saw then history moving towards an endpoint. Now, interestingly, they took a kind of Christian concept, which is that actually history has an end that we're moving towards, and they secularized it. So instead of the eschaton, the coming kingdom of God, the new Jerusalem coming down from the heavens, they saw it as this future utopia. When we got rid of all the superstition and doubt from the world, we would reach this point where, you know, it's going to be just golden days. And the thing holding us back is superstition, religion, and belief. So the word secularism is deeply framed. And that concept has been so key to secularism. But to do that, you have to then deliver what you're promising. If you think that the world's going to get better the less people go to church, the more that you apply scientific rigor, the more that you have a rationalist worldview, you want places which have that worldview to actually then deliver the goods. We've had societies which took this. There are different forms of it. There's a Western version in terms of liberal democracy, which has had this idea at certain points. You see this in places in Europe, Scandinavia, these places where you have churches which are beautifully kept. People still pay tithes, but they pay them as part of just their social fabric of the past, something they admire, but they're not going to go to anymore because they're moving towards a sort of kind of Scandinavian concept of social democracy where religion is passing. I think it was Eurovision. I don't know if you guys would know what Eurovision is. Do you guys know what Eurovision is? Yeah, it's like the World Cup of like ridiculous singing. Australia's in Eurovision, which is really weird. We're not in Europe, but anyway. I remember it was like maybe 2010, I think Sweden or Malmo or someone hosted it, and you know, they have this little funny video before, and you know, it was this couple getting married in a Swedish church, and the whole joke was that they literally said Swedes don't take religion seriously. You get a Marxist, Stalinist, Leninist version of this, and you see this in the Iron Curtain, where you know, religion was completely removed from the public space. And you saw, you know, this march towards a sort of the materialist dialectic that would bring about the new Soviet man and this new communist society at the end of the age. But societies fall into crisis, as the Soviet Union did at the end, when it doesn't deliver on the promise. So secularism, my first point is, secularism is structural. What do I mean by that? Secularism is structural. It has to provide a bunch of stuff that enables you to have the myth that you can live without God. It has to socially deliver a bunch of stuff that gives you the idea that you can live without God. Now, one of the reasons I think in my country is perhaps more secular than yours is, you know, we have so many of these different things that in our history, you know, because we're this country which was initially this penal colony and when European settlement started, and then it sort of like slowly improved. Like Australia, America starts as a utopia as a nation. Australia starts as a dystopia. You have this like prayer when the Mayflower, whatever, rocks up, and we then have a bunch of convicts rocking up with a bunch of British soldiers being punished, Indigenous people having their land taken from them, and the women are on a ship called, I think it's the Lady Julia, who are all sex workers. And then they get here after this massive voyage, not here, get to Australia after this massive voyage, and just like, here's some rum, go into the bush and, you know, go wild. So Australia, as Alan Hirsch, my old boss, used to say, America starts with a prayer meeting, Australia starts with an orgy. That's an Alan Hirsch line, not mine. But Australia, weirdly, just has this, you know, grows this society. And in Australia, where, you know, you've got incredibly functional public spaces, incredible infrastructure. Sydney just built this robotic subway that's just like unbelievable. Healthcare is just unbelievable. All these things which I deeply cherish and benefit, when everything's provided for you, it's easy to believe that God is not needed. However, when those social contracts begin to fray, and what governments, experts, who we give away some of our freedom to in order for them to deliver something to us, and then secular authorities don't deliver on the promise, all of a sudden you start to have a doubt. It's like the person who, you know, believes that every person who asks for prayer, asks for healing, will be healed, and then that person doesn't get healed, the seed of doubt can come in. That is happening at the moment. What has been happening, particularly since 2008, is an ongoing delegitimization of institutions which give the dominant narrative. And one of the dominant narratives is that the world was inevitably heading towards a utopian future which we would slide and glide towards without any stress. But the reality on the ground, again, real life is where the action is, that is not what people are seeing. And when that doesn't turn up, people go into this very personal existential crisis. And that is particularly happening in this country. And it's particularly happening in a city like Portland. And so when the ideological promises, when you're told things will get better, but then they don't on the ground happen, people start to doubt secularism. A second point leads into this. Ronald Engelhardt, who's a religious sociologist, had this concept that if you look at the world, the more secular countries in the world are those which have high levels of wealth and high levels of security. So the most secular countries in the world are places like Sweden, Denmark, New Zealand, Australia, because we have the highest standards of living of the world and we have highest sort of public things, very functional political systems. And then as you go down, you find that countries which are in war, which are poor, often have really strong religion. Now, part of the world that I just described, I said something that happened in 2008. 2008 happens, and one of the solutions to the global financial crisis is to do quantitative easing, printing of money. This has been a controversial element of economics. It was something that was advocated by John Maynard Keynes during the Great Depression and in some ways was successful at different parts of the Great Depression. Different economists debate that. But they go into quantitative easing during the great global financial crisis, and it does work. In Australia, we did not have a recession because we stimulated well during the global financial crisis. However, printing money is like a shot in the gun that you don't want to do too often, an antibiotic that if you give it too much, you begin to develop a resistance to it. So when COVID happened, not many people know this or realize this, that when COVID happened, in the first few weeks of COVID, there was, because we were so focused on lockdown and not getting ill or whatever, that we did not notice that it was the biggest economic depression since the Great Depression. The stock markets utterly plunged. I mean, imagine you're running a company which, you know, you're running FedEx, like you're thinking, what on earth's going to happen? You're running a store, a cafe. It went a shock through the global economy, but we didn't necessarily feel it. Why? Because we printed money. Everyone around the world printed money and handed out stimulus checks. So it's like when someone, you know, keels over and has a heart attack and they put that sort of like shocker on their heart. If you're a doctor, you're thinking, what's he talking about here? This is the worst description ever of what happens. I've just seen it in the movies. You know, like they electrocute your heart. That's my interpretation of it. And it's, you know, it shocks it back in. So we did that. It was a kind of shock economic therapy. Now, that had to happen in the moment because we were in big trouble. Imagine if we had a global depression at the same time, what was happening with COVID. So it works, but there's always trade-offs. And the trade-off was the inevitable return of inflation. Jack Dorsey, former owner of Twitter, put up a tweet, I think it was 2021. He goes, inflation is coming and it's going to change everything. See, before this, interest rates were almost zero. That's the other thing that happened. I won't nerd out on this, but the Bank of Japan introduced this unconventional monetary theory, which is what if you could borrow money and it costs nothing? Even some places went to, you can borrow money. I think in Japan they had a point where you can borrow money and we'll pay you to borrow it. So when you can just have a credit, it's like giving your teenagers credit cards that are just limitless, that you never have to pay back and say, like, head to Vegas, 14-year-olds, with credit cards that have no limit. What could go wrong? This is what happened. So all of a sudden, governments like my state government and your government, which are progressive, all of a sudden could pay for all this stuff. And it seemed like the consequence of that would never come. But it has. And inflation has come. It's gone down a little bit in the US. But even just the fact that we had then adjusted to everything, people taking out mortgages, expecting that we were now in an ongoing low interest rate world, and even interest rates going up a little bit has changed everything. Borrowing money now is really difficult. So my state government, which is one of the most progressive, is the most progressive in my country, all these projects, it was like, we're doing this project, the other states aren't. All of a sudden now, it's just freaking out. There's a massive amount of debt. The United States has an astronomical amount of debt now. I'm going to make one political statement. Should I? Yeah, okay. What's so interesting is most of the promises of both your candidates are saying nothing about debt. Because both of their promises are actually undergirded by just going to more debt. And this is just kicking the ball down the road to the point, but that we've now hit this. So what happens is when inflation happens is your standard of living inevitably economically goes down. And this is cost of living pressures. This is what we feel. The overarching numbers of the economy is like, but you know, the American economy is doing all right because the seven companies, the Magnificent Seven, tech companies are doing really well. And what Oxfam found is that after the pandemic, we're seeing the gap between rich and poor massively grow. So what's happened is the economy's grown because a small, tiny percentage of a tiny, small group of people have gotten incredibly rich, but the average person's going to the grocery store going, man, this is getting more and more expensive. I just paid what for a coffee? And they want me to tip? Like this is, you know, this is something that ordinary people are feeling. Okay, so back to Engelhardt's scale. If the more secular countries are the countries where people can live under the impression that they don't need God because it's very safe, they're not threatened by a foreign power, there's not internal unrest, where they're quite wealthy, they've got universal healthcare, everything's good, you then bring them down five or six notches, all of a sudden spiritual questions begin to come up. The world, the West, has gone down several notches. Great Britain just did their budget. Labour gets in Great Britain, the left-wing party, after a long period of conservative rule, and everyone got them in, things are going to change. They come up and say, we've got no money left. Poland will overtake the United Kingdom in the next 10 years or something in living standards. And you're wondering why you're hearing stories about God moving in Britain? This is part of it. Because people all of a sudden are going, hang on, that actually the ideology that we've been living under is not matching the reality and my life is not getting better. And so you're Gen Z and you're going, I'm probably never ever going to buy a house. I'm not going to live as good as my parents did. And then you'll be part of this story where things did improve post-war, people improved like that, and then all of a sudden you're like this. And you're in the gig economy, you have very little security, and all of a sudden, like the story of that young man, goes to New York, thinks it's going to happen, doesn't happen. This is a story that's being felt all over the place. And can I just tell you, and I'll talk about this more in the second lecture, but there are so many people who are feeling this and they have no one to talk to. And you get to a conversation in a store with someone. My wife was just in a conversation with someone at the store and she just asks a few probing questions and just it all comes out. And this woman says to her this, she starts talking about God, her business is struggling since COVID, she's got a health crisis, and she just says to Trudy, my wife, something's changed since COVID, hasn't it? It's not just about the pandemic, something has spiritually changed. The third thing is, we're approaching the end of individualism. I'll say that again. We're approaching the end of individualism. Are you crazy, Mark? What on earth are you talking about? I'm saying just people push deeper into individualism. You've got to be mad. Well, individualism ultimately is based on human agency. The ethic of individualism that really does, you know, exist for a couple hundred years, but really takes off post-war in the United States, defined by the youth culture of the baby boomers, rock and roll, you name it, counterculture, whatever you want to do, is one where the individual has agency to define themselves and push back against really the dominant sort of Puritan-inspired social conservatism that grew up in the builder generation who'd gone through the war, were traumatized, came back, and I just want to have a refrigerator with food in it and I want my life to be really secure and safe. You have a generation which defines against that by all of a sudden inventing rock and roll. Elvis, you know, goes and twists his hips on CBS and it's an outrage, you know. This then just grows and grows and grows. And mass culture does drive it. Mass culture brings the Beatles to the world. But we're at a moment now where we've gone from individualism to, I think then we went from the 90s into a hyper-consumer culture where we had intensified individualism. But we are now in a moment where we have little agency. The average person is algorithmically manipulated more than we realize. We literally have the smartest minds, some of the smartest minds out there who are getting you to click on stuff. And you can just tweak this, tweak this. This is why TikTok is currently, you're constantly under pressure by your government, because why would you give a foreign government this tool to deeply just turn up? So like all of a sudden you can just turn up. We're going to talk more about there's a bank run. What if TikTok decided to just go, yep, get your money out, Gen Z, from the local bank, because America's about to have a massive bank run. You could, in 24 hours, cause this. And this has happened in different places around the world, political interference. And this is not just TikTok doing it. All countries are doing this. And so what happens is we're approaching this point. And Yanis Varoufakis, who's a Greek-Australian economist, makes this really interesting argument. He's a left-wing guy, but then he's really annoyed the left. Because what he's arguing is capitalism is over. Because capitalism ultimately is competitive. It's a market where I might buy from you. What's your price? Well, there's a better price over here. You've got a better quality. I'll choose that one. What happens when everything is controlled by a few oligarchic monopolies who will literally know when you're pregnant and haven't told your mum? Who know when you're depressed? Who literally have emotional mapping of you and who can emotionally manipulate you and say, this is the issue we're going to talk about. This is what I want you to buy. And so actually the market individualism is, you know, so much of consumerism defined contemporary individualism. And Yanis Varoufakis says that actually if capitalism's dead and it's really now just become almost monopolistic, controlled by one or two big companies, it means individualism is dying. And you actually don't have as much agency over what you think as you do. And what's happening is this has not pushed people into more freedom. It's actually increasingly creating this kind of exhausting hedonism. I remember 2019 when I was here last, I went to San Francisco and I'm catching the Uber through this San Francisco night, exhausted after the long flight. And I just see all these different apartments just built that have grown around the city. And we're on the freeway coming to town and there's this giant billboard. And on the billboard, there is this woman wearing a bikini that's made out of marijuana leaves and it's advertising an at-home delivery app for marijuana. And I just thought, game over. You just get the stuff at your home and you just go into a kind of narcotic bliss where you're narcoticized, is that even a word, from the pain of the world. And hedonism is no longer this exciting thing where there's desire. Romance is gone. Have you noticed this? Romance is actually something which is generated by the desire of not having something yet. There's all these great romantic novels and poems written about the unrequited lover who, you know, wants to have that person over there. In hookup culture, there's none of that. Just constant sexual activity with no desire, because everything you want is now at your fingertips. And this honestly creates a kind of world that's almost like the movie WALL-E, where you're just given everything you want. And what that does is kill any kind of entrepreneurial, agency-driven individualism. Now, that had its own problems. But we're in a world where people are realizing that individualism is being crushed. And it's making them look at alternatives because they are no longer, in Michel Foucault talked about societies of discipline where you are needed to told what you should do, you know, and then he said you should break against that, the normative culture you should rebel against. But we're now in a culture where the normative culture is actually non-normative and you're actually not oppressed by what you shouldn't do. Like there's not all these taboos. You're oppressed by all the things you could be doing. So the individualist now is sitting at home looking at a screen, just in a sense in this narcotic blur of different kinds of things, consumerism, drugs, gambling, pornography. And they're constantly just looking at what they could be and feeling this tremendous weight of shame upon them. Individualism is falling over. Two more real quick. Charles Taylor talked about the Buffett self, that a secularist had this sort of sense where the people before in other countries, in other societies, in the developing world, in contrast to Western secularists, have this idea that the world's enchanted, it's filled with spirits and there's magic and there's gods and there's all kinds of things out there. And we're not like me looking at the world critically like this with a sort of invisible wall between me and what I see, object, subject. That actually people in other cultures have been porous. So that means that they're afraid. They go on a travel, just a pilgrimage to somewhere and they're concerned about the river god or they're concerned about the sprites that could be in the trees. This is what medieval Europe was like. But that went with secularism. But the interesting thing is, in cities like yours or mine, particularly yours, even more so than mine, the more people that engage in psychedelics, mushrooms, ayahuasca, executives going off on ayahuasca retreats in in South America. The more people that increasingly push into sexual experimentation, the more people that push into the occult, is that secular wall, which is so often hard to breach to people who just didn't feel secular at all, that is starting to break down. And the other thing that is happening out there is you're having people having existential crises, but also what you're having is people who are having dark spiritual experiences and they need deliverance. And they're oppressed. And this is a story you're hearing more and more and more. And again, too, like, I mean, literally, when you've got the US Navy saying, yeah, we've got images of what could be UFOs, all of a sudden we go from the impossible seeming possible of COVID to now the impossible seeming possible of, like, there's stuff out there. There is so much spiritual hunger. I'll end on this story. Melbourne, lockdown, 2 years, couldn't go more than 3 miles. And when it opened up, one place I really wanted to go was just this center of downtown, because it was just outside. I couldn't get there. And I was like, is it still there? Is Melbourne still there? I've not seen it for 2 years. And I go in with my daughter, she's 16, we catch the train in. At that stage, a lot of stores were closed, gone under. And we get into this beautiful old 19th century Victorian arcade or Victorian mall, and it's called the Royal Arcade. And just this really iconic part of Melbourne. And we walk around it, and I'm like, wow, there's just all these shops are empty. And then we come around the corner and there's this long line of young people, mostly young women, mostly Gen Z. Well, what is this? Is this some new pop-up yogurt store? You know, is there some like drop of some new, I don't know, mashup of sneakers, you know, between some Adidas and some, I don't know, Stella McCartney? What is going on here? Get around the corner. And I see this figure at the end, and it's like this really creepy figure that they're all lining up in front of. It's a hooded figure, like in The Lord of the Rings or something, and it's holding a staff. I'm like, is it a person? I can't see what it is. And as we get closer, it has this straw face with eyes, and it is creepy. And it's effectively a god. And these women, mostly, are then turning left, and they're going into this psychics place to have readings, spells cast, stuff taken off them. And I'm like, wow. I thought when lockdown first happened in Melbourne, I thought everyone's going to go to the pizza joint and hang out with all their friends. I remember the first few months, like, everyone's just going to burst back into church and say, you know, we go like, yeah, I told you needed community. Didn't happen. What's the first place they go? They go to this neo-pagan thing. It's deep in your city. This is deep. We just got some data. We just got a new congregation, new location. We got this data back that in that area, it's no longer the anchor store that people used to go to the area for. That's gone bankrupt during COVID. It's gone now to a smaller building. It's not the restaurant that used to be there. Everyone used to hang out. That's gone under. The number one reason we found people come to this area is to come to three psychics. Thousands of people driving to these psychics, right? So what is happening? This is the last one. I'm going to talk more about what I'm seeing around the world in the next one. But we're seeing incredible stuff start to happen. And last week, I spoke in Houston at the New Room Conference, and Stephen Foster, my friend from St. Aldate's in Oxford, and me and him have been comparing notes about what's happening in our churches. We're seeing a profound change and profound fruit starting to happen. And he spoke before me, and we're texting each other. He was on video, I was in person. And he said this. He said, in Britain, and I would say this is the same in Australia, we're moving from post-Christian to a kind of pre-Christian reality where people know nothing about Christianity or they're willing to give it a go because everything else is falling down. Final stat. We have this research done in Australia where it says Australians in the last 2 years since the pandemic have lost trust in almost every institution, government, big business, big sports, big banks, you name it. The one thing, and I was utterly, utterly shocked, gone up a little bit, the church. Now, that's not your country because I know there's different stuff and it's here. But you know what I realize it's about? They're going, everything is stuffed. We're going to give you guys a try. There is a moment you need to readjust that you are not in one of the most difficult places to do church in America. You are in possibly what could in the next 5 years become one of the most fertile grounds for evangelism and actually see the turnaround of the church in this nation if you're willing to push in and listen to what he's doing.
What a way to end the episode. I'm sure you are all moved to go pray, journal, tell a friend, or just go start talking to people about Jesus on the street. No matter what your next step is, I hope today's talk has moved and encouraged you in your walk with Jesus. Also, great news, this was actually just part one of our time with Mark Sayers. A whole other talk that is kind of on the action side of this talk is available now wherever you're listening. So go check that one out as well. Thanks for listening.